is the value in the word. That the anger you was writing, golden insights to the world, or the demons you were fighting, grab an older piece of work, grab a seat, let's talk it through, be an open book, let's take a look at paragraphs lost, that's what we do.
You're listening to Paragraphs Lost, a show where writers dig up the work from their early teens. You know, the stuff that made their parents proud enough to keep in the attic, or the fanfiction that lay forgotten on forums, brimming with ambition and unfortunately lost to the world. Each week, our guests pick a story from those years, read them aloud, and learn to forgive themselves for being 13 years old. I'm Tim Hewitt. This week,
Lover's Heart for Lunch. A meal without regrets. She does the calorie count. 0 grams of fat. Oh, that's a fun one.
It's pithy.
Hi
there, welcome to Paragraphs Lost. Today we have Melissa. How you doing, Melissa?
Hi, doing well. Thank you for having me, Tim.
It's awesome to have you here. So what have you brought today?
I have, let's see, 4 poems. 2 longer, in my opinion, and then 2 very short ones. That I wrote right around the age of 19, the ripe age of 19.
And what were these written for?
Probably, like I was taking poetry classes at the time, so they could have been written for class, but also I, like, really at this age embraced poetry as, like, a way of life, like, to the point where I was just, like, constantly writing. I also didn't have very many friends, seriously, so I spent, like, a lot of time writing and typing away, so potentially for class, but yeah, also.
So you didn't write handwritten?
I normally, like, if I write using handwriting, I'll start with, like, 1 or 2 lines, but inevitably, after I get going, if I'm able to get going, I have to get on the computer, because mm-hmm. I handwrite too slow, I think, for, mm-hmm. like, for the energy, if, you know, if I'm there.
Right, right, I'm the same way, and also, I just get hand cramps, because I never grew up writing by hand, and,
Oh, yeah?
No, so, that's distracting, too, and I feel like just a better writer on the computer, and that just might be the font looks better, so it reads better, but...
Yeah, no, definitely, yeah.
So, tell me a little bit more about yourself at 19. Were you in school at the time, or...?
Yes, I was in school, so I was at San Francisco State University, go Gators, funniest mascot ever, but, yeah, I was in school. I had sort of, like, just discovered poetry. I was deciding which path I wanted to go down, and it was definitely going to be something in the humanities. And then I just sort of, like, you know, it sounds weird to say that I found poetry or, like, it found me, but it really was, like life-saving at the time. And it was just like, oh, this is something that I can study when I'm in school. And mm-hmm. honestly, I didn't think of any of the consequences of that, you know, like getting a job or anything like that. You know, my parents were nothing but supportive. My mm-hmm. dad did try to, I think, have one conversation with me, swaying me in the direction, like trying to sway me in the direction of hospitality, like studying hospitality. You know, poetry just completely had won me over already at 19.
What was the earliest experience with poetry that you can remember?
Honestly, I mean, like, Shel Silverstein. Mm-hmm. And I still have a couple of his books here right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was, like, super influential, and it's funny, we were just talking about the drawing with the, right. You know, before the podcast started, like, drawing with the text, and that's mm-hmm. something that really interests me about Shel Silverstein, like, unlike stories, I don't know, it was just something else.
Mm-hmm. And he often incorporated the drawings as part of the poem, not just illustrative of them, which was cool. When you say you discovered poetry, though, at 19,
yes.
who was inspirational to you, or was this just you started writing things that looked mm-hmm, like poems mm-hmm. and then you realized that was poetry?
I think I had met a friend in college, actually. It was, like, our very first class together. We just became, like, instant friends, and this was at age 18. And Juliet had already been writing poems, like, on her own, and she was very inspired by songwriting. So that was almost, like, my first, like, contact with it. It wasn't necessarily in class. It was my friend Juliet, who I'd met in school. And then through her, you know, I got more interested in poetry. She was also really into Dylan Thomas.
Mm-hmm. I was in Under Milkwood. actually, oh, in high school. Yeah.
Wait, that's amazing. I just bought that book literally the other day.
It's fantastic.
yeah, I'm so excited to read it. It had, and honestly, it was one of those books where I was attracted by the cover. Uh-huh. I was just like, wow. And it's Dylan Thomas, and I'd just been reading Shirley Jackson.
Is that the black cover with like the little white river line on it, or did they make a new version of it?
I think it's probably a newer version because it's green. It's like this bright green. Okay. Yeah. Anyways, Dylan Thomas was one of the first encounters I had with poetry through my friend Juliet. But it was, like, when I say, like, I discovered it, I found it, like, that was in class, and that was through a couple amazing teachers that I had, you know, that really, really cared about their, like, young poetry students. Like, they really they really cared. And also being in San Francisco was really helpful, of course, because there's so much history and there's so much going on, you know, and in the present moment, you know, still with poetry. So a couple things. It's like a three-pronged experience, you know, Juliet, school, and the teachers I had, and then the city itself.
You mentioned poetry being important to you in a therapeutic sense.
Yes, definitely. You know, we all have our own like college experiences or whatever. And I, you know, for me, like I ended up, and this would potentially have come up in our discussion, but I chose not to read this poem because anyways, I dated somebody in college who was, turned out to be like a pretty horrible person.
It happens.
Yeah. and you know, I really like lost my like sense of self. Like I said, you know, I had no friends anymore at that point because of, you know, he was just like gaslighting me left and right. I had no idea what was real anymore and what wasn't. And poetry was like the one thing during this time, which was honestly like 2.5 years of my life in college. Poetry was like the one thing I had, and it was like the people that I found through poetry and the events that I went to, you know, over in Oakland and like, you know, over in the East Bay, like things like that, that like, you know, kept me like, I mean, kept me in San Francisco and yeah, kept me afloat.
Great. Yeah. All right. So let's read this first one here.
Yeah. So the title, like I said, it's, you know, the fonts are all weird, and I didn't change them for this, right? I wanted to keep them in their
Preserve them.
Preserve
the
them
historical,
in their
original form.
Right. Yeah. So the first one is, the title is Evie Zamora / Lux Lisbon. And, yeah, I guess we'll talk about it after, so I'll go ahead and read it. Evie Zamora / Lux Lisbon. Evie Zamora, born to be bad, or at least with the desire to be bad. 13 and ready for self-destruction, spearheading the trail of experience. Authority holds no power over someone as hopeless as she. If fictions could converge, this little fire of a female would do well to befriend the most promiscuous of Eugenides' suicide sisters. Silent, impossible to pin down, operating outside parental law. 14 and too wise. Tragedy is inevitable. She knows she is alluring. That usually leads to longer cigarette drags and, in the case of some, sex on the roof. The neighborhood boys can't take their eyes off her, this peculiar gem. Even when she's dead, their thoughts constantly drift back to her. She craved to live outside the rules. She played with their hearts like a game of cards. They can't ever forget that laugh. They mustn't or they won't survive. At least that's how they see it. Who knew taking your own life was so sexy? Maybe it's a good thing their paths haven't crossed until now. There probably would have been a sixth suicide. Lux Lisbon. Oh boy. Oh boy.
So my first question actually is, I'm not, you're having a reaction here, so I'm going to give you a moment. So I'm not familiar with Evie Zamora, Lux Lisbon. I take it these were real people or?
They're characters actually. And it's, I had to look this up this morning, actually. I knew who Lux Lisbon was, a character from the suicide, the Virgin Suicides. And then Evie Zamora, at first I thought was a poet, and I was trying to look her up to find her, and then I was like, oh no, this is a character from the movie 13.
Oh.
Do you know that movie?
I've seen the cover, but please.
So yeah, you probably know enough, right? But it's just about this, like, you know, two 13-year-old girls, and they're sort of like toxic relationship, but also like it's, I mean, at the time, like I found it probably like kind of beautiful even. I don't know how I feel about it now. I maybe would need to watch it again. but the thing about these two characters is that they're young and they're female and they're kind of fucked up. And mm-hmm. I think that I identified with them,
mm-hmm.
you know,
in the, born to be bad sense, which by the way, do you miss like being able to just start a poem that way? Like...
Right. Oh my gosh. The audacity of it all. Like, you know, yeah, I do. Oh my gosh. What did you say?
So this was, would you say this was kind of the person you were and you were like identifying with him in that sense?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, definitely. In the way of like, you know, I've sort of always had not a problem with authority, but like of my siblings, I always like to, you know, this is a good example because this is my background, you know, of my siblings, like I was the one that got in trouble and that, you know, broke the rules and had, you know, run-ins with the cops, like all of these, you know.
Operating like, outside parental law.
Literally, yeah. Yes. Like, isn't it so funny, like, how much, though, of this, like, I'm sure is, like, coming from my own experience, like, mm-hmm. rather than the movies? Or, I don't know, it's sort of like, it's blurring these lines for me. I'm, you know, some of this is from real life, some of this is...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, wow. The line, if fictions could converge, like, just, like, so abstract, like, there, you know, it's so abstract.
Is that not a line you'd write today?
Probably not. probably not.
Okay, mm-hmm. Matt. So, what do you, you had a pretty strong reaction to finishing this. Is this mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. when you wrote this, it had that autobiographical sense? Like, are you reacting to the person you was or specifically yeah. what you're writing here?
I think so, yes, a little bit. Especially because, like, of the really, like, heavy content at the end. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I think what's scary, not scary to me, but, like, what's so shocking to me is, like, you know, like, I wasn't taking this lightly and, like, that's worrisome. Although everything...
In what way?
Well, then, like... You know, it's like, I don't know, like, there probably would have been a sixth suicide. It's like, mm-hmm. I'm talking about, you know, the character, Evie Zamora, like, what if she had been, you know, in the virgin suicide? There mm-hmm. would have been a sixth suicide. But, like, you know, just for me, like, yeah, writing was, it was a form of catharsis at mm-hmm. this time, especially.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, it's like... Oof, a little close to home there.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, it's like being this honest when you're young, you know? Is right. it so much easier? Like, it's so much it's, easier to be honest.
It's not only easier, it's sort of unintentionally. So my finding is that a lot of teen writing, even when it's trying very hard not to be, that just makes it more transparent.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
We don't learn how to hide these things very well.
No, it's sincere. Like, yeah.
Yeah. Which is nice. Do you, are there parts of you that still identify with this 19-year-old, do you feel? Or do you, mm-hmm. is there been a lot of change since then? When you read this, do you, like, how easy is it for you to put yourself back in this place?
Yeah. I mean... It's not hard necessarily, but like I'm trying to turn away from it because it's mm-hmm. like I don't, you know, I wasn't like super healthy at this mm-hmm. time.
Sure.
Although I don't know, you know, I was writing a lot. I was writing into it. You know, like I remember I think one of my professors at some point said this, like you're writing into the crisis. You're writing into the trauma. Mm-hmm. You know, to maybe come out on the other side or whatever. You know, I don't know if that has to be the end goal, but
mm-hmm.
yeah.
Interesting. All right, so let's move on to the next one.
Yeah. Okay. So, this poem is called Americana Madonna. And I have to say, this was the first good poem that I thought I wrote. I thought this was good at the time. And it's like, part of it is like, I just have to say like the form on the page, you know, we can talk about that after. But right. Yeah, so we'll go ahead with this one, which also written around the age of 19. Americana Madonna, 1, storm. Under fistfuls of stars, she dances. Dreams her dress is outlined, colors inside. cuts along dotted lines, glides through eyes into upside down Eden. Today she lives 100 lives in technicolor. Not fooled by scattered light or hints of myth, spinning she is a tumbleweed, a spitfire wind, an organic imprint. She makes hearts stand still, breaks news in two. Her story is spherical. There is no such thing as death, she repeats to herself, a lethal miracle. There is no such thing as death, she reappears to herself.
I can see why you felt this way about this poem.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is quite cool. So the one thing you've done here is you start with one storm. So I was expecting like breaks with different titles. Was that because this was just from a different document, or were there other sections to this poem?
I think there were other sections to this poem at one point in time, mm-hmm. but. I think the reason that I cut it right there is because the other part, like, involves the person that I was dating at the time. And, uh-huh. like, no need to put that fool on blast. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not worth our time.
We don't need to go into it. So yes. We'll stick with the first half.
Yes. This is the first half. This is where the good stuff is.
Uh-huh. What did you mean by the title Americana Madonna, do you think?
You know what? I think that I definitely know I like the way it sounds, uh-huh. and also, I think I was really sound driven at this point, and it's interesting because like now that I'm looking at these two poems we've talked about, like, you know, in concession, is that the right word? Like I can see a very small growth, you know, like it, I'm super sound driven in this poem, Americana Madonna. Even the title just like sets it up, and then like. I was noticing when I was reading, like, inside, dotted lines, glides, eyes. It's like, whoa, really heavy on the eye sound. In that first paragraph, or whatever, first, stanza.
There's a lot more economy of language here between the next one, too. And I sense that focus on sound, but it's not like you were sacrificing meaning either to get it. At least not in that last... stanza.
Thank you. That makes me really happy. Thank you.
No, it really comes through. And I think it's sweet. Do you recall what your thoughts about this poem were at the time?
Yeah.
Or at least this first half before you went after that guy.
Yes. So I think that this poem seems to me like it definitely went through like at least one workshop. Mm-hmm. Which would have been potentially my first workshop ever.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's an interesting experience, isn't it?
I think so. Yeah, I think yes, it was an interesting experience, and that was one of the things that made me realize I loved poetry. It was like, wow, I just get to sit around and talk about like the cool things that language can do with other like-minded people. That's amazing. Workshop is the best.
Yeah. I feel the same way, and I mean, there were people in workshops who were like. It's really that there's two types of workshop people. They're the ones who like love sharing their poem and volunteer first, which is I was on that side. One for that reason, because it was just fun to talk about and I like participating. But two is also like I wrote something and I can force 20 people to read it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, yes.
This is the only time I can guarantee I have an audience because you're getting graded on this.
Yeah.
Like, that's nice. But then there's the other type of person who's like, not my turn to share. Like they get really antsy about that. So I take it you enjoyed.
I did. Yes. Like, I had a really great experience. Part of it, I think was San Francisco State.
Mm-hmm.
The, you know, classes being super diverse in mm-hmm. terms of like, you know, yes, like race and ethnicity, but also age, which I found really, really great. Like, especially for something as creative as poetry, like, it was really nice to have a lot of different eyes and ears in mm-hmm. the room. And I think, yeah, I think this poem probably went through at least one round of that first workshop, which I think would have been, I don't want to say this incorrectly, because I think it's Steve's class, though. Steve Dickison, he's a poet and professor at San Francisco State University. He also runs the Poetry Center,
mm-hmm.
which has, like, you know, an extensive collection of recordings and things like that that they make public, I think, make public online. And it's just this really great yeah, thing. And Steve Dickinson is this, like, amazing, just, like, tornado, like, this calm, though, a calm tornado. Uh-huh. I'm going to use an oxymoron here, like, calm tornado of a person. And I think this was in his class, and he really encouraged me. But because you were saying, like, the economy of language, right?
Mm-hmm.
Compared to the last poem. And it's like, that's because someone told me to cut all these words, right? Probably. And I did, and I listened to them. And so that's where we are. But I like, thank you for saying that about the last stanza as well. Do you want to tell me why you think that? Like,
So I like the tension between the word repeats and then the word reappears, which fails to repeat, but also means the same thing in terms of reinventing oneself. Coming out looking the same and feeling the same, but having gone through something now, specifically a storm. And that playing with there is no such thing as death, because this is, there's deaths of selves and then revival of selves and death of selves. And that can feel like repetition. Without quite being repetition, it evolves. It evolves from repeats to reappears, as it does in the poem. So I just think that's quite clever.
I honestly think I might harvest this. Like, seriously, like, yeah, if anything comes from this, I'm honestly thinking about harvesting parts of that last stanza. Because I also, like, I'm like, oh, I wrote that. That's not so bad. there are other things I hate about this poem, though. But
Like what?
Well, like, to me, it did seem really, really sound-driven, like, to the point, I agree that, like, in the last stanza, like, not sacrificing meaning, maybe something is actually happening there, but, I don't know, the first two stanzas, like, spitfire, wind, you know, I do like hints of myth. I'm not, like, totally hating on that. I guess, okay, maybe it is just the first stanza with the inside, lines, glides, eyes. Like, ow. Ouch. My ears.
I like that, you know, we're not part of a generation that really has any emotional connection to Technicolor whatsoever, but we're still using it.
Yes, I know, I love that. That's so funny. That's so funny. Yeah, well, it's ours to use. We can do that.
Based on just, I think, kind of like the, because I'm not even sure what people are trying to say when they use the word Technicolor, other than it's sort of built on this idea of being fake, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's, like, how people used it as a metaphor before, and we've just kind of carried on that metaphor. But
yeah,
nothing is produced in Technicolor anymore. Like, it really doesn't apply to any media I consume.
It's funny, though, that you say that, because I probably didn't know. And I say that I probably didn't know, because I literally just learned right now, in this very moment, that, like, that's sort of the metaphor that people were using it for.
Because that's just my reading. Like,
that's so funny. No, because I like, probably was thinking of it, like, in terms of, like, a rainbow, but it's, like, I capitalized it, and, yeah, but that just opens up a whole new side of things.
I think, like, rainbow is probably what Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat, like, was going for.
I was raised Catholic, so there's no shaking that off. Yeah, I loved the most recent Met Gala. Anyways, the theme was something to do with the Catholic Church, right? Oh, my goodness. So funny.
Like who was it?
Somebody Rihanna had Pope hat?
The Pope hat was good, but somebody had a hat with a nativity scene.
Oh, my God. Actually, I didn't see that. That is so funny.
I got into really, really into Twitter over the past year, and that I would have had no exposure to the Met Gala, but I'm glad that I did now.
Yeah, it's just something. Now you've been made better for it.
Now I know about Pope hat, and now I know about the Met Gala and the Nativity hat and people's various, like, that's hilarious. That's outrageous. Yeah. Like, debate over it, which is very special.
So funny.
But yeah, just to get back to Technicolor.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting word, and it's I think one that's gonna be preserved in the language, despite the fact that like hanging up the phone, for example, nobody hangs up a phone.
Yeah. Anymore. When you, like, on a dock or whatever.
Yeah.
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 Hangs up a phone. I'm like trying to think, what is that like?
I'm gonna hang up now. And it's like, yeah, it's gonna be part of our language forever, and it's not at all.
It's just obsolete now.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah,
it's not a good description of what we're actually doing.
Yeah. Well, okay, here's some things that I wouldn't do now in terms of, like, my process for writing a poem. Like, I wouldn't use the, like, word Eden so haphazardly, you know, because it's, like, it's such a weighty term.
It's a big one.
It's so weighty, and just, like, to, like, throw it in there and just, like, that's that. It's kind of like, you can't do that. You need to, like, build something around it. Like, yeah. Uh-huh. Anyways, like, Eden, Technicolor, these things that, like, now it's, like, I just big terms and things. I don't really know what they mean, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, I wouldn't do that now, I hope. Maybe I still do. I don't know.
They probably had a certain emotional meaning to you at the time, but, like, in terms of communication, yeah, they're just such broad terms that they could...
Mean anything
from like fake to rainbow.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah,
for example.
That's funny.
I like the title of the next one.
Oh yes, thank you. That one, yeah. And honestly, speaking about being honest, Black Sabbath on a Tuesday evening. I mean, like that's probably what I was doing at the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even though I don't know if I'm like, had I read Frank O'Hara at this point? I don't know. Anyways, shall I read it?
Sure.
Okay. Black Sabbath on a Tuesday evening. Beatnik Jackie Onassis has heavy metal pickaxes for teeth. She takes a bite of her lover's heart for lunch. A meal without regrets. She does the calorie count. 0 grams of fat. Oh, that's a fun one.
It's pithy.
Yeah, I know. That's so funny. It is.
I like the Beatnik Jackie Onassis, how it plays with pickaxes.
Yeah, right?
I feel like that was just the line in your head, and like, I've got to get this down.
Mm-hmm,
Onassis, mm-hmm. Pickaxes.
Yep.
That's pretty good. So you said you were probably listening to Black Sabbath on a Tuesday evening?
Yeah, probably.
Was that... a band that inspired you at the time, or was it?
Honestly, not really. I mean, mm-hmm. I've always been like very, and I think a lot of people are like very wide ranging in their, mm-hmm. their musical tastes. And mm-hmm. rarely do I ever like get into an artist to the point where I think they're inspiring me in terms of poetry. I'm trying to think, I'm looking at my records right now. I'm like, I'm trying to think if I can pull an artist, maybe like Karen O, of why am I forgetting her actual band name right now?
I'm not familiar with the name.
Okay, you're gonna know her band though. I know it. Yes.
Oh yes.
Yeah, of course.
Yes.
Yes, Karen O. Like in terms of like music that has you know gone far enough with me to like inspire my work. She's the first person I can think of, mm-hmm. one of the only people. What about you? Interesting. Do you like let your music, do you find that like inspires you?
You know, so from beginning in college is where I discovered poetry as well. And while I'm still a reader, I started this project a few years ago where I wrote a musical, and ever since then I've kind of moved to lyrics. And I do draw a distinction between the two, but that, mm-hmm. I think it held a lot of interest for me because if I'm critical of myself and my old poetry, one of the things, and this is probably because I'm primarily a fiction writer, I tend to be very specific and not very vague with the things that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. I've always felt like poetry really needed from me to be more comfortable with just not explaining everything that I meant, or mm-hmm. not writing something that would be decodable to other people, mm-hmm. because the best poems I've ever read weren't that, you know.
Yeah.
But that's very much how I write, as I felt like I was making a puzzle with poems. So what lyrics let me do was the best lyrics are just not specific. Like, they're things that need to be accessible to everybody.
Yeah.
So it's really good practice for that, and to not be too clever, and to really like pull back.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. No, the vanity of the poet. I know, it's so real. It's like, look how clever I am. Look what I did. I'm so smart. Yeah, totally. I love that. It's like, it's humbling, maybe, mm-hmm. or more humble.
And then my wife is a musician, so I did have somebody who could put those to music after totally. I'd written them. So I'm getting back into poetry now, and what I found is that I got so simplified with lyrics that now it's actually kind of hard to get back into.
Yeah.
Like, now I do need to actually complicate things up and be more responsible for like the message and making something more artful than lyrics typically are. But in doing that, you know, I was listening to a lot of lyricists, and there are a few that I like right now. And one I'll recommend is Ezra Furman, one of the best lyricists, I think, like working today. Who does a combination of both. Just writes stuff that's very specific to him, but just has a broad meaning. And I should say them, actually, but very broad meaning without losing kind of the power of where it came from. So I find a lot of inspiration from lyricists, definitely.
Wow. Yeah, that's awesome. That's different. See, I love hearing about people's like processes. That's one of my favorite things about like writing and talking about writing is just hearing like, where do you come from on this? That's wonderful.
So did you have any fascination with Jackie O at the time, or was this...
I mean, I was going to say not particularly. However, like, given just the theme of, like, the poems I've read so far, like, definitely I latched on to, like, strong females right at this time, which I think, like, a lot of women do, or, like, young women do. You know, you want to see yourself represented in some way. And so I think, like, she falls into that sort of just the time in my life when, like, the what I was grabbing onto, you know, what I was like grabbing onto in terms of like inspiration, and like content, I guess, for my poems, like strong females. Again, though, like to me, this is like you said, like this was a line in your head and you just had to get it down. And I think that that's probably where it came from. Just, thunk, it like hits you on the head and then you have to just get it out. Cause it's like, I'm like, what does it even mean? I don't know, but I, like, kind of like it. I feel like there's an image there that, like, could be unpacked a little bit more.
The point is, I was not able to write anything else until
this one got out of me. Had to put it down. I mean, like, that happens to you, right? You're just like, gotta put it down.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And it is very much, like, some of the worst poems I've ever written were because there was something in my head that it just had to go, and I knew it wasn't going to be good, but if I didn't get it down, then I'd never write the next good thing.
Yeah, totally. That reminds me of the, like, kill your darlings, right? Someone's probably said this on this podcast, right?
Not yet.
Really?
Actually, there have been no darlings murdered. Okay. We're a big fan of darlings.
Yeah. Kill your darlings. Someone said that. Some famous poet said that. You know, I feel like this poem that I just read, though, is it not, like, a little sassy? I feel like the sassiness is starting to come out.
The last three, A Meal Without Regrets, she does the calorie count, 0 grams of fat.
Like, whoa!
It's very, what's the word, like, femme fatale. Like,
yeah! Oh my gosh, I love that. Yeah, thank you.
So we got one more here. Yeah.
Which
still best title yet
is called Title Me, yes. And I just want to say, you know how I had to, like, dig deep into my cloud, whatever, to, like, find these poems from, like, 2011, 2010. And when I found them, I just sort of I copied and pasted everything I could find onto a document and then just copied and pasted from there. So that's why, like, this, it's in red, which means it was probably, like, in draft form. You know, this is not a finished poem. So just keep that in mind.
Okay.
Title Me is what it's called. It's a good day to be immortal. She eats poinsettias, puts resurrection upon the dinner table. The seams of her circumstances begin to itch. I have some things I want to say about this film.
Well, let's go.
I have some things. Okay, I mean, first of all, resurrection, right? There's that Catholic upbringing again. Uh-huh. There it is. Just like that language, like, will forever and always be a part of, like, my, you know, main, like, vocabulary grab bag.
Uh-huh.
It's rich. Also, the last two lines here, like, this is going to get a little, I don't know, how graphic do we want to, like, get on this podcast? Okay. So, well, just, like, one of my friend, and it's actually my friend, it's not me, I'm just not, my friend, no, my actual friend, not gonna name her, just told me she had a yeast infection, like, yesterday, and so so nat. I'm sorry. Like, I asked. No, how graphic.
Yeah, no, you're good. You're good.
And so, the last two lines of this poem now, I literally, as I was reading them, I was like, oh my God, this is so gross. It just reminds me of an itchy vagina, which, like, vaginas are wonderful and beautiful and great, but, like, itchy vaginas are no fun. The seams of her circumstances begin to itch. Like, oh my Lord.
Yeah. You definitely have a different reading of your poem.
I know, I'm sorry. I had to say that, though. I had to say that. Because it was just, it's such a strong feeling for me right now that, like, you remember, you have to just put that line on
right,
paper.
Right,
no,
I get it.
Say it out loud.
I get it.
So you're say it out loud.
So you would write this the same way, then, because that isn't the image that you're trying to. This poem about an immortal. Do you remember writing this?
You know, a little bit I do. I remember the line about poinsettias.
Are those poisonous, by the way?
I think so. Like, to animals. If, like, a cat were to eat, we always have them around my house at Christmas, and my cat and my dog are fine, so just be smart about it. Animals, just
have
be
fun,
smart
kids.
About it.
Have fun. Do what you will with the poinsettias.
Yeah.
Just, you know where the number is if you need to call.
Be careful. Yeah. So we have poinsettias, which I do remember, I think. I'll tell you, I don't remember anything about the first line, right? Because, again, it's so vague. It's so...
It's a good line. I mean, it's a turn.
Okay.
So you've got, it's a good day to die, but it's a good day to be an immortal.
Yeah, and you know what? Like, maybe at this time I was reading, like, Greek myths, perhaps?
Uh-huh.
That, you know, Edith Hamilton has that famous book called Mythology. Mm-hmm. Many of us have read it. I feel like maybe, I don't know, maybe that's where that came from. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Possibly.
Title me.
I mean,
anyways.
It suggests that there are bad days to be immortal, which I imagine are true.
Well, I like that. See, that's a better line than the one I wrote.
There are bad days to be immortal?
Yes! Well, I think that's better.
It suggests that line.
That's so funny.
All right, well, you can have it. That's fine. I'm not going to use it.
Yeah, thank you. I will take it and put it in my next poem. So,
but yeah, puts resurrection upon the dinner table. I got a little lost there.
Right.
But then I'm back on, like, the seams of her circumstance begin to itch. anatomy aside.
I think I just
like the sounds of the seams of her circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
And it's clear you're still playing with tone. Is do you find in your poetry now that this is something you still are attracted to? Like, you'll play with the noise more than...
Yes, actually. I can't say that that's not true. I don't know how, like, this is a little, like, out of left field, I guess, but the poems that I am writing right now, many of them, this sounds very weird, and it's so hard to describe, but many of them are titled with just four numbers, and that was, I did that for a lot of reasons. I just, like, didn't want to pin it down at first. That was my main thing. And then I was like, oh, I really like this. But the four numbers that I choose, I end up sort of letting the numbers, like, guide the sound in the poem. Like, for example, I have a poem called 2122. And I was thinking about that in terms of the number 21 and the number 22. And so there was a lot of sort of, like, doubling happening in that poem, or, like, I don't know, it's so weird and hard to explain, but I do feel very sound driven still. Mm-hmm. Still. Not in the way that I was in that poem that I hate, though, where it's like eyes disguise lines or whatever. Like, not like that. More interesting than that, I promise.
I heard a poem that had the line realize.
I both love and hate that so much at the same time.
I think it's bold.
It was
a slam poet, and you know, it probably fits better there.
Yeah, certainly.
Than anything else. It stuck with me.
It got its job done.
I appreciated the audacity.
Yeah, for sure.
Of going there.
That's so funny. I'm trying to think if I have anything like that. Oh my gosh, because, like, I don't know. There's just so much at this point. I can't believe I've been writing for like these are from 2011 and it's 2018. Mm-hmm. Like, that's a long time.
7 years of work.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
When was your first published poem?
That was in my undergraduate magazine, mm-hmm. Transfer Literary Magazine. And as a senior, I got one of my poems in there. And, you know, I actually couldn't find it, surprisingly, when I was looking for this. Although, I know I have a copy of Transfer at my mom's house somewhere. So okay. It's safe in her house somewhere. But yeah, it was San Francisco. Mm-hmm. Oh, so here's my thing. I tell people this. I have only gotten published in San Francisco-based literary magazines. Like, nobody else will have me. Just SF. Like, I don't know why, but...
So, you just speak their language.
I guess so. I guess so, because there was Transfer Literary Magazine, and then recently I had a poem published in Zizva, which was, it was a big deal for me. Mm-hmm. You know, they published some pretty amazing people, so...
Every Californian who listened to this podcast loved these poems.
Yeah, what are you talking about?
They're great.
I hope so.
So, like, looking back on these, you mentioned some of the things that you disliked about the poems.
Yeah.
What do you see here that has stayed with you, and what are you glad that has stayed with you?
Mm-hmm. I mean, one thing, and this sounds kind of like heavy and big, but it's true, is sort of like the closeness to death. Mm-hmm. That I feel when I write, like, both in terms of content as well as just, like, you know, not to get, like, too mystical or whatever, but sort of, like, the beyond, you know, like, that word, you know, whatever we don't have words for that you're sort of going after, mm-hmm. when you're creating, you know, whether it be, like, a fashion garment or, you know, because, like, fashion is art, you know, like, it can be, you know, whatever you're creating, you know, a garment, a poem, whatever. It's like you're chasing after something that doesn't have words for it. And death to me is really close to that, partly because we don't know. Mm-hmm. You know, it's part of the beyond. We don't know. Anyways, I try and keep that, like, close when I write. I think I can't help but do that. And that to me is present in this work. I mean, specifically in the third stanza of the second poem I read. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess mostly there. I do feel its undercurrents, though. I mean, in the first poem, of course, as well.
In my senior year of creative writing, after we'd all gotten to know each other as writers, there was this one of my cohorts was there, and we were all saying our goals for the year, and the professor, what do you want to do this year? What do you want to do differently this year? And this girl said, well. And she was, like, the best writer in the class, but she said, I want to write less about death this year. I don't want to write so much about death. And T, who is the professor, she just shook her head. She said, everything anybody writes is about death.
Yes, right? It totally is. Like, it's, you know, if creation is life, then, like, you know, just by default, its opposite is present, too, I think.
So she might have stomped on that goal, but no, that really stuck with me.
Yeah.
It was just reminded when you were talking about it now. So thank you for, I guess we can end on that super cheery note.
Yeah. Great. Perfect.
Thank you so much for listening. These are great.
Yeah. Thank you for having me, Tim. That was really fun.
Thank you for listening. Our guest this week was Melissa Hohl, that's H-O-H-L. You can find some of her work online, but we'll be posting some links to it on the website. Here's what's coming next week.
I wish them stale air and no windows to open. I wish them low shelves and no knee pads. I wish them patrons who shove teen sex books in among books on New Jersey and New York. On Fridays, I wish them the honor of patrons in the video racks. I wish them broken copier machines. I wish them patrons who come in at 5:25 p.m. near closing time with six loud children of varying ages and sizes to return 60 books, 20 of which are 5 days late.